front. We were able, by the grace of God Almighty, to infiltrate Zionist media channels and broadcast to the resistance. As you know, the Zionist government and media follow Al-Aqsa Space Channel, and this is confirmed by a Zionist analyst. We could enter homes outside Palestine on TV and radio and show how the resistance succeeded. And this got into the minds of the Zionist enemy within their own homes and influenced their policies as part of the psychological warfare that took place in the 2014
war.
This is what the Zionist occupation did not want their own people and the people of the world to see, that the Palestinian press has credibility over the news coming out of the Zionist press, which came from statements made by Israeli settlers. They don't have credibility, but the people believe Palestinian media, and this is the fruit of our determination and perseverance.
يعني هذه النظرية لم تأتي من فراغ بل أتت من مثابرة وأتت من تصميم.
The Israeli occupation and its army first tried to keep the media away from the scenes of carnage during the 2014 Gaza war. But when that didn't work, they went after the journalists. Some of the most important facilities destroyed by the Israeli occupation in 2014 were the five Al-Aqsa Media Network facilities.
The headquarters at Burj al-Shuruq Financial Management Office, the offices at Al-Nasr and the office you are at now were all targeted, as well as the broadcast center.
We all felt like this was the end of us when the broadcaster was targeted. But we don't believe that we are more important than our children and our homes, and the future of Palestine and our feelings do not shy away from embarrassment. Our purpose is that our message to the people should not be disrupted, because we believe they need us every second. We were back on air after a few hours of the attack, which was met with a positive response from the community.
The Al-Aqsa Media Network had aired resistance operational information that allowed the Palestinian resistance to defeat a group of Israeli soldiers. An operational failure for Israel was not an option, and so they had to put a stop to the leaking of the truth to the outside world, and then to replace the truth by way of omission or denial.
Repeat with me, Allah the Almighty, Allah the Almighty, Allah the Almighty. No true God but Allah. Al-Qassam brigades have just captured a soldier. Allah the Almighty, Allah the Almighty, praise to be Allah. Let those wounded people at Al-Shaja'iyya rejoice tonight as Al-Qassam brigades captured the soldier.
Those words that prompt me to stand and salute Ez al-Din al-Qassam brigades and the souls of their hero martyrs, I greet you from the heart. This is a victory speech that we have started sharing on this blessed night. All respect and salute is due to the Ez al-Din al-Qassam brigades. We will start commentating after a short interval. Stay tuned.
That which was reflected through this war, that the Palestinian narrative is credible when it comes to news, we were keen about that. When the Zionist enemy said that five people were killed, we would replay the same information, but without exaggeration of such, reporting that in fact 50 were killed, and we believed that the narrative of the resistance that we knew was genuine. When the Qassam Brigade said they killed eight Israeli soldiers in Nahal Az, we published it, and this was validated by the Zionist enemy later when they were forced to then confess that indeed eight of their soldiers were killed. We believe the resistance narrative because they are entitled to be believed.
We believe we have a revolutionary privacy that distinguishes us from others. Frankly, we all received threatening letters to the order that several houses of colleagues were pounded with bombs. One of our colleagues in radio was bombed directly by an F-16 fighter jet. This man was a journalist who was not engaging in any resistance but targeted due to his employment.
The Al-Aqsa Media Network was but one of 19 media organizations broadcasting from the Gaza Strip, which were bombed, leaving them partially or totally destroyed. Al-Shaab Radio was one such network building reduced to rubble.
We tried to take with us some devices such as a transmitter, which is an expensive device that a radio broadcast relies on. I remember at one time, a colleague started to walk upstairs when all of a sudden an unmanned drone fired rockets at our building. We had to escape the building with no time to take anything with us, not even archives or any electronic device. Conditions were extremely bad when we were leaving, as some were injured due to the panic and stumbling around at 3 o'clock in the morning, seeing nothing in front of them. The tower we worked in after being hit collapsed into debris. When we couldn't grab anything from inside the radio station, we thought we had lost our important archives. We believed we had lost a voice for the people, months of work.
Another Palestinian media organization assaulted by the Israeli forces was a national agency which provides services to local and international TV stations. This particular site was filmed by a surveillance camera while under attack by Israeli warplanes that let fly several missiles, which decimated the area, compelling and hard evidence of a war crime.
We were offering round-the-clock coverage of the deadly night, which they targeted more than 30 houses throughout the Gaza Strip. Many people were displaced from their homes in the north and in El Shajaya. We're not targeted as journalists individually, but they bombed our whole building, bringing it down with 3 missiles. It means the occupation is trying to silence media, audio and images. It's a crime. They want to kill the journalists in one hit. There were 36 journalists inside the building at the time. They targeted the building with no prior warning so that we had no chance to evacuate the building beforehand.
It's natural for journalists to be frightened, cautious, and not want to stay long in places that clearly are a potential target of Israeli missiles. Many evacuated from their news desks and resorted to working out of hotels in their continued efforts to write and prevent their words and video footage from being silenced by the invading Israeli forces.
I come from Khan Yunis city. I had to move to Gaza because of the very harsh security situation. As a journalist, I come to stay in a hotel where I am sure I can provide the needed life and coverage services to the to Press TV. I was injured in 1 in the morning. I was attending my work. I was doing this work in an area that is known to be full of journalists from the different media outlets, including some foreign journalists who are doing some live coverage and media coverage in general for some international and regional media channels. This is the area where I was targeted and injured, and where I sustained my injuries. I tried my best to stay awake. I tried my best also to establish what was happening, but it was far beyond my capacity because of the very strong explosion and because of the surprise and because of the injury.
Palestinian journalists continued to deliver audio and video reports during the war that so displeased the Israeli government and military, it issued a statement which Palestinian journalists interpreted as a preface to direct targeting.
What happened is that Israel, prior to targeting the first journalist in the Gaza Strip, Hamid Shahab, through their media office, issued a public statement ordering foreign journalists who had entered the Gaza Strip to go to the beach hotel for sanctuary. We issued an immediate statement telling Palestinian journalists that it meant they were being targeted as long as they were not included in the statement. That was our perception of this.
On the eve of July 9, 2014, the first Israeli aerial bombardment took place in what is considered the high-class neighborhood of Al-Rimal in Gaza City. The target of the raid was an automobile carrying a sign that read press on it and driven by journalist Hamid Shahab with co-worker Hatim Selmi at his side. They had stopped by Hatim's home to briefly check on his family, whom he had not seen in a while. Shahab remained in the car outside. A minute or two later, while Hatim was with his family, a missile hit their home, and Hamid Shahab lost his partner.
I was at the office working for the fourth day in a row without going home. I went then, returned home, had a bath, and changed my clothes. I saw my family, but decided not to see my mother as I knew she would become too emotional. You know how mothers get after their sons are away for a while. Hamid phoned me to say he was coming to my home. I went to the balcony to watch for him, but he said he couldn't see me. He told me he was entering the street, and I was looking down both sides to find him. He entered from the Kazim area, from the opposite lane, because he was coming from Al Sabra neighborhood. So he said he is now in the street, and I told him I saw him and ended the call. I was going downstairs. My mother was there, and she commented that she had not seen me in a while and that she missed me. I was touched and moved back to kiss her hands and head, and I was about to hold my brother's hand when there was a huge explosion.
It was Ramadan, and we were leaving the mosque after Taraweeh prayers. We sat with my cousins and a few uncles next to a press vehicle. Another car parked behind us to pick up Hatim Selmi, a journalist who was upstairs. The driver's mobile rang, and the next thing I was aware of, we all woke up at the hospital.
I held one victim in my arms, but he was lifeless. I moved to the next, and they too were dead. Then another and another. I wanted to work my way through those that died so that I may find someone alive to rescue. The injured I could help. The driver was nowhere to be found. The car was unrecognizable. The explosion was so severe. I searched for the driver, but found nothing until a first aid officer found his legs and half of his abdomen. The car suffered a direct hit. It was indeed the target. I imagined myself sitting next to him when the explosion occurred, cut to ribbons, dying together as martyrs.
As the war on Gaza continued, the targeting of journalists too continued and escalated. Israeli occupational forces assassinated six journalists, all in 1 month, prompting many other journalists to go into hiding.
I would often warn him, but he always insisted on venturing out to film and record the truth for the world to see. It was in his blood, and he worked passionately day and night. The only time you knew he was alive was when he would call and tell us he is in a certain place and safe.
He would film the martyrs and help carry the injured on his searching to find them all. He used to come home asking about me and my day. He hid his blood-stained clothes from me because he knows I have high blood pressure and diabetes. He didn't want me to feel upset.
Rami was very courageous. Whenever I saw him putting on his helmet and vest, I would ask, "Where are you going?" He would say he was going to do his job and show the truth to the world. I reminded him that we have young children that need their father. But he always said, what's meant to happen will happen. We can't lock him in a room.
Rami Ryan did not respond to calls from his parents and wife to stay home and not cover the war and go out in search of crimes being committed by the Israeli aggressors. Rami is a photographer and an only son. He is married with four children, and his job supports them all, the whole family. Rami's family, like other families of journalists, worried incessantly every time a bombing or massacre occurred. It was a traumatic time for all.
I had my child Rami after 14 years of marriage. I spoiled and doted upon him as he was my only son. He married after high school and had two girls and two boys. I always scolded him, saying he is an only son and all would be lost if someone were to knock on my door and tell me something happened to him. May he rest in peace. He never listened to me. His work was a message he had to deliver, even if the price was his blood. He was prepared to die for the cause.
I phoned him in his last days. He was away so much, and I told him that he needs to come home and spend time with his children, as they missed him so. He promised to come home early that night, and he did come, and we ate dinner together. He showed us some of what he had filmed, horrible scenes from his trips accompanying the PRCS as they evacuated displaced people from Ash-Shaja'iyya.
The last time I saw him, I was in afternoon prayer and he was about to leave. I raised my voice saying, Allahu Akbar, to make him wait. Then he came to the window side and waited. Once I finished my prayers, I told him that his kids are still young and that because of the risk he was taking, that one day he would die in the blink of an eye. He told me that Allah will look after them and told me that if I locked him in a box, he would die. So it's better that he lives as he was meant to. I told him that he exhausted me with worry, but that he's also right in what he said.
One day, Rami journeyed out to cover a massacre in Al-Shaja'iyya neighborhood. His photos taken at the site were the last images he ever took. Scores of rockets and missiles rained down on the same area after the initial massacre, and Rami was martyred.
The incident of injuring and killing and murdering Rami Rayyan in Ash-Shaja'iyya neighborhood when the Israeli occupation forces targeted the market, killing with the deceased Rami more than 17 people from Ash-Shaja'iyya neighborhood. That was another evidence that our job is full of risks and that our life is at the stake, but that also that surprised us, but that also made us determined that we are the guards of the truth.
Rami's family lost their son, husband, father, and sole breadwinner. The only consolation for the family members is that Rami died exposing the truth embedded in the photographs he took of the massacres and other crimes committed against the Palestinian people.
May he rest in peace. He has been martyred, which is a privilege. Praise the Lord that he was chosen. He was a kind-hearted and a good man. There is nothing worse, though, than when a child asks you, where is her father? You might answer that he's in paradise, but then the child says, when it rains, dad will get wet, and so he should come here to stay warm with us. You answer that it won't rain on him, as the Lord protects him in paradise, where he has everything.
The war in Gaza lasted for 51 days. By the end, dozens of journalists had been killed or injured. Witnesses to Israel's great loss over its battle to monopolize and control media exposure, which severely damaged its reputation on the world stage. Witnesses to the success of Palestinian resistance in the face of one of the largest and most technologically advanced armies in the world today.
Here there are seven martyrs and about 30 wounded. Of the wounded, some have permanent disabilities. In every war by Israeli aggression, there's a great sacrifice from the Palestinian media sector, and I can tell you that we have no problem in giving our souls freely to expose the hellish barbarism of the Zionist regime.
We have lost in this war 18 brothers from the family of the press in Gaza. If journalists didn't put their lives on the line to expose Israel's crimes, if they did not succeed in this mission to be the messengers of the occupied peoples, then they would have not been targeted by the Israeli army. I think the Palestinian press succeeded in their endeavors that shows their love for their homeland.
There was a distant challenge this time in that the Palestinian media became a serious counterweapon versus the Western-dominated Israeli media and narrative. we were able to refute their narrative of lies and manipulation of the truth this time. They overrode our signal, but we broadcasted from other stations. When Al Shaab radio station was targeted, the Al Quds station was saying, "Here is Al Shaab voice from the studios of Al Quds station." When Watan and Al-Aqsa stations were targeted, we said we were their voice. We made it clear if they targeted one studio that the whole Gaza radio network would all be the voice for Al Quds or Al Shaab or any other Palestinian station attacked. We think we succeeded in this battle to make the truth in war prevail and to successfully counter many of the lies broadcasted as Israeli propaganda.
Even if a war erupted right now, we will still continue our work. For instance, I'm from the neighborhood of Beit Hanun, where almost every family has been displaced. My family stayed initially in a collective center. Our house was targeted, and thirdly, my place of work at Al-Watania Media was taken out by a missile. It took me just 4 hours to get back to my duties. Every journalist is subject to risks, just as the families and the thousands of children displaced. I didn't see my family for 52 days. Even when injured, I kept on working. Palestinian journalists are fierce workers in their dedication to expose the occupation in all its aspects.
Almost immediately after the war came to an end, media personnel returned to their offices to work. And staff of the destroyed networks found new premises to set up in and continue their brave cause.
As soon as the radio station was bombed by an Israeli airstrike, we were back in the saddle coming up with ways to get back on air reporting events. Even with the loss of the archive and the old premises of Al-Shaab, we started working and thinking of how to revive our efforts despite the sustained risks. Nothing will stop us from our path to serve the Palestinian cause.
Al-Aqsa radio station represented the resistant media, a voice that will never run out of means to continue. We have infinite alternatives and options that the enemy is not even aware of. Our signals will never be permanently ended. With Allah's will, we will return to the airwaves, always, one time more than we are knocked down.
They may have killed or deported journalists, but their pictures are immortal witnesses to all the horrendous atrocities committed by the Israeli occupation on Palestinian soil.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Iranians have proved with their ability to circumvent Washington's terroristic sanctions that the U.S. cannot do a damn thing and is totally helpless in curtailing the rapid increase of Iran's progress in different fields. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Kahan International wrote, Iran, which is blessed with the world's fourth largest crude oil deposits and the second largest natural gas deposits, has, with the recent discovery of lithium deposits, now become the second largest holder of this rare white gold found around the globe. This, however, does not mean that the country, which accounts for 7% of all minerals found worldwide, such as gold, uranium, bauxite, marble, coal, iron ore, zinc, copper, lead, chromium, gypsum, molybdenum, strontium, silica, and barite, world's sixth largest producer, sits idly and hopes against the hope for the lifting of the illegal U.S. sanctions for its exports. No. To the dismay of its enemies in Washington, the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is already a top-notch exporter of such agro-industrial products such as saffron, pistachios, and the world-famous Persian carpets, besides achieving self-reliance in defense industries, the nuclear fuel cycle, aerospace, stem cell technology, the cyber world, and artificial intelligence, to name a few, is now a leading exporter of electricity to neighboring countries. Iran, which now generates 90,000 megawatts of electricity compared to a mere 7,024 in 1978 before the triumph of the Islamic Revolution, is a regional electricity hub with its power grid connected to Iraq, Turkey, Armenia, the Caucasus Republic of Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, and now Pakistan. In addition, work is in progress for connecting the Iranian power grid with that of Qatar across the Persian Gulf. Meanwhile, the signing of the accord recently in Tehran by the Iranian Minister of Energy and his Pakistani counterpart for increase of the volume of power between the two neighboring countries to 200 megawatts after completion of the project in a record time is indication of resolve and capabilities of Iran's skilled manpower. Iran and Pakistan already enjoy trade exchanges of $2 billion per year, a figure which is all set to increase considerably given the eagerness of traders and officials on both sides of the border to expand commercial, cultural, and political ties. In view of these developments, we expect the politicians in Islamabad to take steps without any fear from the American terrorists for connecting the vital gas pipeline, which for over a decade has not seen any progress. The Iranians have proved with their ability to circumvent Washington's terroristic sanctions that the United States of America cannot do a damn thing and is totally helpless in curtailing the rapid increase of Iran's hydrocarbon and other exports. If the Pakistani brothers realize this fact and go ahead with the connection of the natural gas pipeline, they will indeed reap an economic bonanza and will be able to resolve most of the problems of their country. Meanwhile, Global Energy Network Institute website had earlier reported skilled human resources, vast production of equipments used in the electricity generation industry, and making use of the world's state-of-the-art technologies in the sector have created great opportunity for us to boost our electricity exports, noted head of Iran's electricity company. Moreover, we have many proficient contractor companies specialized in developing power plant building projects, whereas our neighboring countries usually lack one of the two required resources. Therefore, Iran has the potentials for turning into the region's electricity exchange hub. The managing director, Tavanir, Iran's power generation distribution and transmission company, said, "Some of our neighbors, such as Afghanistan and Iraq, and also the eastern parts of Turkey and the regions located in the west of Pakistan, are heavily in need of our surplus electricity." Persian service of ISNA news agency quoted Muhammad Ali Vahdati as saying. In addition, he added, "Given the different off-peak and on-peak electricity times in our country and our neighboring countries, electricity exchanges are in the interest of the both sides." Referring to the connection of Iran's electricity grid to those of the neighboring countries, Vahdati stated that preliminary works are underway to that effect to connect Iran's electricity grid to those of Georgia, Russia, Syria, Lebanon, and Tajikistan.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The German government is planning to implement a new migration policy where asylum seekers will be forcibly sent to other countries in a clear violation of international conventions on the protection of refugees. Already, refugees in Germany are having a hard time and are under pressure to leave.
The worst part is that a lot of people go crazy here in this compound. You hear 8 months, 1 year, they just come and tell you your asylum is over. You have to go back to Italy. And you know you are coming from Italy because of the life was not good for you.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. In the first segment of our program today, we are focusing on reports that German government is considering deporting asylum seekers and refugees in the country to Eastern Europe and North Africa to then have their asylum claims processed there. We're asking, why is Germany intent on implementing a proposal that is contrary to fundamental human rights? In the second part of our program today, we are looking into reports that the monarchy in Morocco is using an Israeli-produced Pegasus spy program to clamp down on the country's opposition and the Western Sahara independence movement. Stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Germany dumping refugees in Africa. The German government is planning to implement a controversial migration policy that will see asylum seekers in the country literally dumped in Africa or Eastern Europe. This decision is expected to be implemented by Joachim Stamp, Germany's first ever special representative of the federal government for migration agreements.
However, activists working in the field of asylum and migration say Germany has the means to welcome migrants and therefore the decision should not be implemented.
Political leaders have to realize that in creating a feeling of panic, they are helping the extreme right when it tries to denigrate refugees. We want people to show more solidarity with those driven into exile, both in society and in politics. That's how we avoid a repeat of 2015.
And now to discuss Germany's controversial plan to eject refugees and asylum seekers in the country and dump them in Africa, we have contacted Jonathan Ofey and Sir, the publisher of Africa Briefing. Thanks a lot for your time. Now, why has Germany decided to join the bandwagon of European countries such as Germany and Denmark that plan to dump refugees in other countries, especially in Africa?
Yes, I don't know why Germany, you know, is trying to, well, it's adopting, you know, that that policy. Because in principle, I mean, if the refugee is from Africa and want to send them back to Africa, it's fine. But to send other nationals from other continents to Africa, you know, like Britain is trying to do, to me, okay, look, Africa, we have our problem. Africa has its problems. So you don't, you know, add the problems by sending refugees from other continents to Africa. Okay, no matter how much, I'm not sure that, you know, the money you pay to the respective African governments or countries, you know, will make up for, you know, the destruction or the problems that will cause for the country concerned. So I see no reason why, you know, Germany is trying to do that. And again, what Germany is trying to do is against, you know, international conventions. Okay, if somebody comes to your country as a refugee and he's refused that refugee status, you send them back to their country of origin, not to a second country.
The British government announced a new migration plan on 14 April 2022. According to the program, some people who came to the UK without a visa or other permission to enter the country will now be sent to Rwanda against their will to have their asylum claim processed and decided there. UNHCR has opposed plans to transfer refugees to other countries, saying such arrangements simply shift asylum responsibilities, evade international obligations, and are contrary to the letter and spirit of the Refugee Convention. Filippo Grandi, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, elaborates on why they reject such plans.
This creates a huge precedent, if it happens. It hasn't happened, but if it did happen, it would create a huge precedent. It would mean that a country with resources, as the United Kingdom, with systems and institutions that are able to manage the process of granting asylum, that this country renounces some of these responsibilities and exports them to another country. And by the way, a country with less resources and less capacity to do so. So if this were to happen, what would I then be able to say to leaders, to governments in countries that are not receiving, you know, refugees in their thousands as the UK does, but in their millions? Countries in Africa, countries in Asia, in Latin America. What if one of those governments said, we don't want to take them anymore, it's too complicated, let's export them to another country? That would be the end of the practice of asylum as we know it, a practice that is so important to save millions of lives every year.
Despite objection by international organizations, Germany, which claims to respect human rights, is intent on disregarding its international obligations on refugees.
It is just, you know, acting, Germany is just acting with impunity, right? In flouting the international convention on refugees, okay? It thinks it can do whatever it likes. You know, again, it thinks it can do whatever it likes to do because it needs, you know, to take care of its own nuances, of its own dynamics within the country. So it believes it can go against the UN Convention on Refugees.
UK's plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda by force has yet to take off due to ongoing legal challenges. Now, will Germany's plan suffer a similar fate?
Well, it depends on the dynamics in Germany, because what is happening in Britain is that British groups, you know, right groups, refugee groups, you know, and also human rights, other human rights bodies in the UK have, you know, taken legal action against the UK government's move. So whatever happens in Germany will be, you know, as a result of the dynamics in Germany. So you cannot say that because the legal system or the British courts, you know, have temporarily halted, you know, the attempt by the UK government to send refugees to Germany, the same thing might happen to send refugees to Rwanda. It doesn't mean that the same thing might happen, you know, in Germany.
Well, neo-Nazis have rioted in parts of Germany against refugee shelters. There are fears that the number of attacks on refugee homes could go up significantly as more Ukrainian war refugees and asylum seekers from other countries are entering Germany. Now, is the government of Germany reducing the number of refugees in the country under pressure from neo-Nazis and other far-right xenophobes?
Well, like I said earlier, I believe it is partly so. It's an irony because earlier this year, the German government said that, look, they needed to fill about 2 million jobs, right? So they were looking outside, you know, to get, you know, immigrants to fill those 2 million jobs. So why, you know, they are trying to send back, you know, refugees, you know, potential refugees to other countries, you know, it beats my comprehension. It beats my understanding. Okay. And again, like I said earlier on, maybe what the German government is doing is pandering to, you know, the agitation by the new Nazi demonstrations or the new Nazi stand against migration to their country. So I believe that maybe the new Nazis are having some effect on German immigration or migration policy.
Iran is hosting millions of refugees amid cruel sanctions imposed by Western countries that are now evading their international obligations regarding protection of refugees. UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, has on several occasions praised Iran for hosting millions of Afghan refugees despite receiving minimal support from the international community. During a visit to Iran in 2016, Grandi hailed a decree by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, which ordered schooling be made available for all Afghan children, regardless of their residency status.
Last year's decree of the Supreme Leader allowing all children or Afghan children to have access to schools is one of the most important gestures of solidarity that any country has expressed for refugees anywhere in the world in the past few years. I'm also telling the international community that we should not take for granted the fact that Iran bears the largest cost for hosting hundreds of thousands, in fact, millions of Afghans.
Now, what can countries such as Germany and Britain learn from Iran in terms of taking care of refugees?
Germany, Britain, they know it. Okay, look, I believe despite all the sanctions imposed on Iran, Iran has done very well, should be commended for hosting millions of refugees in the country. But look, most Western countries that believe that there's one law for other countries and another law for them. Okay, so they think sometimes they act with impunity. If it does not seal them, they will not do it. It's as simple as that.
Very well put there. The policies of Western countries on refugees are based on double standards, and that's why they are acting with impunity. I would like to thank our guest, Jonathan Ofei Ansah, the publisher of Africa Briefing. Let's now take a short break before our next topic on how Israeli spyware is targeting Morocco's opposition. Stay with us.
Israeli spyware targets Morocco's opposition. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa.
the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The monarchy in Morocco is using a notorious Israeli Pegasus spyware to clamp down on the country's opposition activists, especially those opposed to the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime.
This Israeli spyware can be used to access a phone's messages and emails, look through photos, eavesdrop on calls, track the owner's location, and even film them with the camera. The regime in Rabat heightened its crackdown of the opposition using Israeli spyware during the 12th anniversary of the February 20 movement, which in 2011 was the first Moroccan version of the Arab Spring.
Even with the monarchy using this Israeli spyware to monitor the opposition, Moroccans continue to hold rallies around the North African country calling for greater freedom and to protest against rapid rise in the cost of basic food products. And now to discuss how the Israeli regime is assisting the monarchy in Morocco to clamp down on the country's opposition movement, we have contacted Abayomi Azikiwe. He's the editor of the Pan-African Newswire. Now, thanks for your time today. Why would the monarchy in Morocco use this Israeli software against its political opponents and journalists?
Well, in Morocco, there is an absolute monarchy. They do not want democratization. They are also occupying the Western Sahara, which was a former Spanish colony. And they have been in defiance of the United Nations since the early 1980s, where they declared that an internationally supervised referendum should take place in the Western Sahara over its future, whether it should be an independent country or whether it should remain connected with Morocco. So Morocco is utilizing the advanced spyware of the Israeli regime to curtail opposition in Morocco and also to help combat the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic in its efforts to form an independent state.
Moroccans have come out to vehemently oppose the decision by the monarchy to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. Regular protests take place across Morocco to reject normalization of ties with the Israeli apartheid regime and to express solidarity with Palestinians.
Today we are here as much as with all Moroccans, human rights organizations, political unions that support the Palestinian people, that denounce the war crimes of the Zionist occupation against the Palestinian people. We are also against the normalization of relations of the Moroccan state with Zionism. This march today and all these demonstrations of the Palestinians is supported by several free movements around the world, in Europe, Latin America, the United States and Africa. This normalization must be stopped in our country.
The monarchy continues to suppress citizens opposed to the normalization deal. The Israeli regime was certainly involved in this suppression through the spyware and even weapons.
They want to utilize the Kingdom of Morocco to undermine African support and Middle Eastern support for the Palestinian struggle. It would make sense that they would try to form ties with reactionary and conservative African as well as Arab regimes. We've seen that in regard to Chad, which is a military regime. Also, the Republic of Sudan, they've also attempted this effort as well, even though in Sudan they passed in 1958 when it was a newly independent country. So yes, they are collaborating with these regimes, which have close ties with the United States
as well as France. They feel it would be in their interest to suppress, you know, any type of revolutionary or revolutionary democratic governments in the entire region.
One aspect of the normalization of ties between the monarchy in Morocco and the Israeli regime that has drawn criticism is the purchase and use of the Israeli Pegasus spyware. Now, this spyware seems to be one of the baits used by the regime to entice Arab and African countries to normalize ties with Tel Aviv. Now, can we say that the Israeli regime is now a real threat to democracy and civil rights in countries that normalize ties with it?
It is. It's a clear threat. We see in Sudan that the military regime has resisted any effort to have multi-party elections and to have the military go back to the barracks. We've noticed also within the African Union that Israel is making a new push to gain observer status within that 55-member continental organization. Just over the weekend, the African Union held its 36th ordinary summit in Ethiopia, and a leading Israeli diplomat came to the conference in defiance of the protocols of the African Union. She was uniformly escorted out of the AU summit just this last past weekend, which drew protest from the Israeli government in Tel Aviv. So this is a multi-pronged strategy on the part of the Israeli government that's backed up by the United States to undermine support for the Palestinian struggle and also to prevent the independence of the Western Sahara.
The leader of the Western Sahara region fighting for independence from Morocco, Brahim Ghali, says the Rabat regime uses the most advanced weapons in the world to attack Sahrawi civilians and neighboring countries. He made the statement mid-January referring to the military and espionage cooperation between Morocco and the Israeli regime using the Pegasus software.
The Sahara Arab Democratic Republic leadership understands very clearly that the United States and Israel are part and parcel of the national oppressive apparatus in the Western Sahara. They are working in collaboration with each other to prevent the independence of the Western Sahara, as well as to limit and even destroy support international solidarity for the cause of Palestine. We saw in recent months a visit by the president of the SADR to the Republic of South Africa, where he was greeted warmly. We've also noticed that South Africa and Algeria, as well as other countries, have been vehemently opposed to granting observer status to the State of Israel at the African Union. So all of these issues are interrelated, and it's a struggle for democracy, self-determination, and independence, as opposed to colonialism, apartheid, and Zionism.
The Western Sahara leader also says Morocco is dehumanizing the people fighting for freedom and self-determination in this region.
We are facing a phenomenon that mixes between the military occupation and the exercise of racial discrimination. And in addition to systematic human rights violations and plunder and theft of the natural resources, so it's dehumanizing treatment that the Moroccan is doing, exactly like we have been seeing apartheid doing in many African countries.
And now my last question. Can the monarchy in Morocco silence the opposition and the Western Sahara Polisario Front through spying using the Israeli software? Or are we going to see an escalation of demands for democracy in the country?
They may make inroads in regard to suppressing certain aspects of their struggle. But I believe in the long term that the people of Western Sahara will prevail, that the democratic forces in Morocco will also prevail. I think that if you look at what's going on right now in Palestine, despite all the repression and despite the fact that the Israeli regime has moved even further to the right, people are still resisting in the West Bank as well as Gaza and throughout other areas of Palestine. So I think it will be the same situation in regard to the Western Sahara. It was encouraging this weekend to see the actions, the prompt and very decisive actions on the part of the African Union against the Israeli diplomatic attempted intervention in that summit. And this is going to be manifested on a governmental level as well as on a grassroots level throughout Africa as well as West Asia.
Well, there you have it. The Israeli regime's spyware cannot stop the freedom and democratic aspirations of the people of Morocco and other parts of the world. I'd like to thank our guest Abayomi Azikiwe, the editor of Pan-African Newswire, for his insight today. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
European Union ministers have recently sought ways to curb immigration and send more people away. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT noted countries that refuse to accept their nationals back after they are turned away from the EU will face visa restrictions, the bloc's interior ministers warned recently. They urged the European Commission to take action as illegal immigration to the EU reached its highest level since 2016. Support for restricting the number of visas granted to non-cooperative nations is strong among EU member states. Swedish Minister for Migration Maria Malmer claimed after a meeting of interior ministers recently. She said, "We see irregular arrivals increasing. Returning those who are denied asylum to Europe is a very important issue. The current level of returned migrants is not acceptable." Just 21% of 340,000 illegal immigrants refused asylum in 2021, will return to their countries of origin according to Eurostat data referenced in the meeting. If the political and diplomatic efforts to improve cooperation with third countries do not produce the expected results, the member states call on the Commission to come back with proposals on visa restrictions.